And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Condon. How are you doing,
Phil? Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
We're going to be talking, of course, about the latest developments in Syria, the arrival of Russian planes in response to a request from Syria. There are other planes flying in the area, but they didn't have any such requests. So we're going to be going into such matters with Steve Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com. And we will also be talking later with Zafar Bengash about a number of matters on roughly in the same area. Phil, you have an announcement. Beth Satoun is having a...
Well, first of all, I want to announce that a different book list is having a launch on Thursday night. Gina Athena Ulysses' book, Why Haiti Needs New Narratives, a Post-Quake Chronicle. And then there's a note, English, French, and Creole edition. The book is in all three. So that's at 20 Wilcox Street at 7:30 p.m. on Thursday night, October the 8th.
Wilcox Street?
Wilcox Street, yeah.
What's the number?
20.
20. Okay. Yeah. And there's one on Beth Satoun.
Yes,
am I right?
There is. And there's the Solidarity with Palestine book launches on Friday, October the 9th at 7 p.m. From Puerto Rico to Palestine, Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock to 5 at Beth Satoun. Those events are both free. And next week, on October 14th, Reuben Slonim, Toronto's last prophetic rabbi, he died 15 years ago. His autobiography is being republished, and our friend Ted Schmidt, who was our guest last week, will be introducing and leading a discussion on the work of Rabbi Slonim.
Okay. So, and the date again and the place?
That is Wednesday, October 14th at 7 p.m. It's a $5 admission, and that's at Beth Satoun, which is 612 Markham Street.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
Everybody knows Beth Satoun. Anyway.
Everybody knows where Beth
Satoun is. Go to Honest Ed's and ask somebody. It's right next door. I believe we're joined now by Stephen Gowans. Are you there, sir?
I am. Hello, Phil.
We're really glad to have you because we've had rather dramatic developments, and we're anxious to know your views. Again, I'll tell our listeners at gowans.wordpress.com. And recently, Stephen's written on this issue of what is taking place in Syria, and we spoke to you, of course, a couple of weeks ago. At that time, this new situation had not developed. That is that Syria apparently has invited Russia to help it in its war, help Syria in a war against the terrorists. And it seems, now the U.S. claims to be fighting terrorists, and they are flying over Syria. Canada sometimes claims to be flying, although I notice we're not updated about how they're doing, any great triumphs or setbacks or anything. But at any rate, I understand we're flying over Syrian airspace. And Mr. Cameron's talking about going to fly there. Some of those states are illegally over Syrian airspace, and one of them is not. I guess that would be Russia. Could you tell us what you think is... of this development?
Yeah, I mean, Russia was invited to intervene by Syria. So it's flying airstrikes right now against various Islamist rebel groups that are trying to overthrow the Assad government. And those members of the U.S.-led coalition that are also intervening in Syria and carrying out airstrikes against ISIS, largely, they are doing so illegally because they're doing so without the permission of the Syrian government. And the United States, or the U.S.-led coalition, is supposed to be a coalition against terrorism, but more specifically, it's a coalition against ISIS and not against terrorism, if we use terrorism to refer to the Islamist rebels. Mm-hmm. And as you probably know, the United States has become a little aggravated by the Russian airstrike program because they claim that the Russians are not only striking ISIS but are striking at rebels that are supported by the United States and its allies. And Russia would certainly counter that these rebels are as much terrorists as ISIS are.
Well, you always follow things very calmly and methodically. And if the U.S. is concerned about people they think are good and they have an alliance, I don't remember them inviting Russia to be part of the alliance.
No, they didn't. They didn't invite Russia to be part of the alliance because the concern was that Russia would support the Assad government, and the strategy that the United States is pursuing in Syria is one in which they provide enough support to the Islamist rebels to put pressure on the Syrian government, to force the Syrian government to negotiate a situation in which the Assad government would step down and yield the state and the infrastructure of the state to someone who is more acceptable to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that the Russian President Vladimir Putin has called out the United States on its use of Islamist rebels to achieve, or at least to pursue, its political goals in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite clear that that's what it's doing. An important part of that coalition is France, and the French President Hollande, interestingly, recently said that he told Putin that any solution in Syria must include the departure of Assad and that Russian airstrikes should only target ISIS, which raises an interesting question. Why only ISIS? I mean, there's another group in Syria, which is essentially al-Qaeda, and that is Jabhat al-Nusra, or the al-Nusra Front.
Yes. And this is anti-terrorism a la carte.
Yeah, there was a UN Security Council resolution in 2014 that condemned in the strongest terms the widespread abuse of human rights by both the Islamic State in Iraq and the al-Nusra Front. So it's curious that the French say that the Russians can attack ISIS but can't attack the al-Nusra Front. Well, I mean, if you're really concerned about eliminating terrorism, then you'd be attacking both organizations.
Mm-hmm.
So that raises the interesting question, why limit airstrikes to ISIS and not to al-Nusra Front? And I think the reason is clear. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not clear, but the reason is that the United States is implicated with al-Nusra. Not only the United States, but many of its allies, Turkey.
Mm-hmm. You've said the magic word. Turkey this morning is... I don't know. They seem belligerent, and then they seem not belligerent. The headlines actually, I find, haven't gelled. I see headlines where Turkey says we accept Russia's explanation of why that one of their planes was near or close to Turkish airspace, and then there's another one about how this could be big trouble. So I don't know which direction they're going to take the story, but. Turkey is in a funny position to be talking about the sacredness of their airspace, given what they've been doing in Syria, right?
Well, they've been intervening, yes. Not directly through their own forces in Syria, but they certainly... I mean, the Turkish president went to Riyadh not too long ago and had a meeting with King Salman in which they arrived at an understanding. And the understanding was that they would establish a command center in northeastern Syria to essentially plan operations for al-Nusra. And there's nothing secret about this. I mean, you can read about this in newspapers because it's in the newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
We also know that the United States has trained and introduced 10,000 rebels into Syria. And if you look at the newspapers closely, you'll see that these groups are, quote, enmeshed with Jabhat al-Nusra or al-Qaeda in Syria. So here we have, you know, the continuation of this U.S. and Western involvement with al-Qaeda and Islamist terrorist groups and using them for political ends, in mm-hmm. this case to put pressure on the Syrian government to force it to step down.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that President Assad, by the way, you have published some of his or called people's attention to his interviews, all of which seem to be rather, I mean, a great source. He lays out his case unlike a lot of politicians, he's very systematic and very clear. He makes a point in his most recent interview with the Islamic Republic interviewer that he said that we have foreign fighters. He said, and the commanders are all foreign, which is interesting. He said, we do have Syrians, some Syrians.
Uh-huh.
But he said the people in command come from Europe. And by the way, he's not discriminating. Some of that, those be, could be people. They could be Islamists. That could be Muslim. But he notices that they're from places like Norway, Germany, Sweden, etc., which indicates, I assume if you're an ordinary Syrian, you'd say that it kind of sounds like a colonial operation of some type going on.
Then it is a colonial operation. I mean, quite definitely.
Perception would be reality, yeah.
I mean, there are rebels from what some of the estimates are 100 countries around the world, tens of thousands of these Islamists, and yes. And where are they being controlled? They're being controlled from outside of Syria or by groups that are associated with, you know, the West. So we have directly the United States and then U.S. allies, Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia. Interestingly, now that the Russians have intervened, their intervention poses a problem for U.S. strategy because the strategy is, you know, create a military stalemate to force Assad to step down. Now we have the Russians actually doing what the Americans claimed that they were doing, which is fighting terrorism. And I was struck that Saudis, being in the U.S., being quite upset about this, have said, okay, well, fine, we're just going to start investing more money in these rebel groups. We'll throw more money at the groups that are trying to overthrow Assad.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we'll step up our funding of terrorist groups in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. Secretary of State has even kind of issued a veiled threat against Russia, saying, well, you know, now that you're intervening in Syria, I think maybe the Sunni Muslim countries and jihadists may direct their attention toward Russia.
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that. Our brilliant Secretary of State, the man who was decorated for shooting a Vietnamese in the back, as I recall, he stumbled. That's a very – I notice that the commentators from the Middle East as opposed from the West, the Middle Eastern people or the and certainly Arab, the great Arab nation, which is makes up, I think, 100 million, I don't know, maybe more, they don't see the Sunni-Shia game as clearly as do the editorial writers at the New York Times. Egypt, for example, is a pretty big country. It has endorsed the Russian planes.
Uh-huh.
They're Sunni in case somebody hasn't told them. So how smart is this game of dividing Muslims?
And I think that's something that's pursued, very vigorously by the Saudis. And they use that as a way of mobilizing support for their political goals. Mm-hmm. And then the Americans do the same.
By the way, the Saudis, this thing about being Sunni, they're kind of stretching it because they have a reputation of being a highly sectarian element called Wahhabi.
Mm-hmm.
And their favorite hobby is killing Muslims. I mean, they have, at the Hajj, they have had a massive loss of life.
Mm-hmm.
And for them to be talking about leading or playing any leading part in the among Sunnis at this moment would be a disgrace because now they, on the purely issue, clear issue of who should be running the Hajj, they have made a mess of it. And many Muslims, by the millions, can't stand them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the U.S. is putting a lot of capital on a rather small piece of real estate.
Yes, that's true.
I wonder about the question now and about the modalities of this interaction we're watching. I wonder, and you must be observing this closely because you discussed in your writings this the new world that's been created by the, going back to 2013, the Russian challenge to the U.S. saying you don't have security at the Council of Authority, you have no U.N. mission, you have no international law that permits you to attack Syria, and the world has been sort of rumbling and cracking ever since that happened. Now we have a situation where a state like Bulgaria tells Russia you can't fly over our territory going to Syria. And then there was talk of other states. I mean, that is a space that should capture the attention of people who elect governments. Of are we or is this kind of behavior of a type that could create extreme tension? I wonder what your thoughts are about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the entire situation is one which can create extreme tension. It's interesting that, well, the Bulgarians would not allow the Russians to overfly their territory that the Iraqis did, and that there's now a kind of a informal coalition between mm-hmm. Russia, the Iraqis, Iran, and Syria.
Mm-hmm.
But given that the Russians are intervening in Syria, though with the permission of the Syrian government, and that other powers are intervening in Syria directly without the permission of the Syrian government, I gather that the situation has become far more dangerous than it was previously.
Mm-hmm. Well, it would be a good time, and it's not happening, is it, in the Canadian political debate, the fact that Russia is now flying there, and they are legally there. The Syrian government is sovereign. No one, they're a member of the United Nations, et cetera. So if Canada is flying from countries that are somewhat belligerent, like Qatar and Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states, actually, I don't know where they take off from, we are being drawn into a situation where somebody might say, that plane doesn't belong there and has to be asked to leave or made to leave.
Yes. Also, there's some talk of having the U.S. coalition aircraft use the Turkish air base as well. But I want to mention, though, that something that the Russian military said, which I found to be quite amusing, the Russian military reportedly told their American counterparts that, quote, foreign colleagues were recommended to withdraw all instructors and advisors as well as those people who were trained with American taxpayers' money.
Salaried. Even the salaried people are in danger.
Yes, in other words, so we're carrying out airstrikes against terrorists, so you better withdraw your people.
Yeah, which, again, we're always back in centuries before. I mean, after we've had great military encounters and the peace is settled, people will be shocked to find out that there were elements involved long before the hostilities broke out. Actually, in my memory, and you could help me with this, is that France and the United States have boasted of having a commando-level, you know, elements on the ground in Syria actually for years.
Uh-huh.
And according to the law, they actually are terrorists. They're carrying guns without authorization and aiming them at the Syrian authorities, and therefore they could be targeted. Actually, I don't see how anybody gets to say, I have kings. You know, you're there. You're not supposed to be there. You were told not to be. So that's the end of that.
Yep. Well, I mean, the U.S. attitude is no country has sovereignty except for the United States. So U.S. forces are free to intervene throughout the world wherever they please. And it's all entirely, while not legal, that it's illegal is irrelevant, I suppose, in their minds.
To oppose them is illegal.
Yes.
Yeah, that They haven't given that doctrine a name. They used to call these things the Truman Doctrine, the Eisenhower Doctrine. You always had to have a doctrine. They seem to have abandoned that. But the Obama Doctrine, the Bush Doctrine, is that they are the only what do they call themselves? The essential state or something, and they are exceptional, which is not a legal word. It's not like the Holy Roman Empire, which could talk about God and all that. But Americans say they're exceptional just because Hollywood says they're exceptional.
Yes. I suppose it would be going a little bit to the extreme, but one might say that it's close to the Hitler doctrine.
It is, actually. Yeah, there is one hates to use that card because it's kind of a used-up card. However, when they make doctrine like that based on the inherent superiority of themselves as an entity, unfortunately, the resemblance, it's kind of like if the shoe fits, you have to wear it. You know, another element. I noticed today the New York Times is suddenly very excited about America helping the Kurds. Yet the other headline, and that's because I read, thanks to the internet and columns like yours, I read that the Kurds are quite happy with the Russian presence. What do you think? Why is the U.S. suddenly energized over the Turks? Pardon me, the Kurds this morning, when the Kurds seem to be energized over the Russians.
Well, I think the Kurds would be energized over the Russians, and anyone who's interested in kind of eradicating the threat that comes from the Islamist terrorists would be pleased with the Russian intervention because it seems to be genuinely aimed at eradicating that threat. Mm-hmm. Whereas the intervention of the U.S. alliance really isn't. I mean, it's aimed. It was Obama who said something about ISIS, which was the goal was to degrade ISIS and then eliminate it. And if your strategy is, Washington's strategy is, to use terrorist forces to put pressure on a legitimate government to eventually force that government to step down, but not to strengthen the terrorists so much that they overthrow the government and create a void and chaos, as happened in Libya, then you're not really intervening to eradicate terrorism. You're actually exploiting these terrorist forces for political ends. But that's not the game that the Russians are playing. The Russians are playing a game of actually eliminating that terrorist threat in order to protect their allies, the legitimate government of Syria. So this benefits the Kurds, since groups like al-Nusra and ISIS would like to see the end of the Kurds or the end of Kurdish aspirations. And I suppose the Americans are interested in the Kurds because they can employ the Kurds to fight against ISIS. They can't get anyone else to fight against ISIS.
I noticed some people bringing in a nice expression from football, that is to say soccer, which Americans do not play, but they call it football. But anyhow, they say Americans have been wrong-footed. They're on their back foot. They have a strategy, and it didn't anticipate, apparently, or it doesn't have a plan B so far, not evident, of what to do should Syria exercise its sovereign right to ask friendly states to assist it. And now they have a big headache standing there, and they don't seem to have I don't get the impression they have a game plan. And I kind of resisted sort of a pun here, but oddly enough, Donald Trump brought up this Trump matter. He said, well, we created a mess in Libya. That's obvious. Mm-hmm. We created a mess in Iraq. He said, that's obvious. They created a mess in Afghanistan. So what are we thinking? Now, everybody says he's an idiot. Well, this seems to be the smartest idiot on the block compared to all these other people who wear suits and try to keep a sober face.
Right. And I think that the U.S. administration recognizes that they've made those errors because their strategy they've been pursuing in Syria is I mean, it's more judicious than the one they pursued in the other countries, because it's one in which they're very careful about not overthrowing Assad.
Although they say it has to go.
Yes. So they just the idea, and they're quite explicit about this, is we have to put pressure on him until he agrees to step down in a, what do they call it, an organized or an orderly transition. And so you recall that there was talk, their concession was, well, maybe he could stay around for 6 months or a year or something, kind of, you know, to facilitate the transition.
Until we find an NGO to run the country.
Yes, and I mean, they've been talking about, we don't want to repeat the mistakes of Libya. I mean, we want a functioning state that we can control.
Well, I guess if they want one, they'll have to ask Russia.
At this point, yes.
Now, what do you think this is going to do to there are, you know, this whole, we've gone through a period here, thanks to papers like The Star and The New York Times and The London Telegraph or whatever it's called, of not acknowledging that there actually is a peace process. It's been there in place. There's meetings been held in Geneva, and now there's a Moscow meeting, a Moscow meeting coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So it is solvable.
Mm-hmm.
If they, you know, they seem to be trying to do all their discussing away from that, but there is already a formula of how it could be resolved. Now, what do you think about that? You suppose those prospects are now improved or not?
Well, I mean, there have been two, I believe, meetings in Moscow. Already, which we don't hear much about because they're not U.S.-led. So if they're not U.S.-led, well, they can't count.
It didn't happen. Yeah.
Exactly. I'm not sure exactly, you know, what the prospects are for any success, because I think the Americans have an agenda, and arriving at some kind of peaceful settlement isn't part of the agenda, unless it involves you know, the kind of Arab nationalist ideology that still exists in Damascus being exterminated and replaced by, mm-hmm. you know, it was kind of like this Comprador anti-nationalist ideology is a kind of thing that we might see in Egypt or Saudi Arabia, in which you have, you know, a submission to U.S. domination.
Mm-hmm.
But the Syrian government, I mean, has taken steps to arrive at some kind of peaceful resolution. And they took steps early on. They did take steps to modify their constitution, to open up space politically for the participation of more groups. They lifted some of the restrictions they had on civil liberties, and the restrictions were related to the fact that Syria is officially, illegally, still at war with Israel. But nevertheless, I mean, they lifted those restrictions. So, and they have been at all of these peace conferences willing to talk to the opposition. But as Assad points out, he doesn't want to talk to an opposition which is really representing a foreign country, but wants to talk to some kind of loyal opposition. Syrians who are interested in living in Syria and arriving at some kind of arrangement within Syria, mm-hmm. and not representing the interests of the United States or Saudi Arabia, for example.
Mm-hmm. On the larger question, by the way, I'll tell our listeners, this is Stephen Gowans. It's gowans.wordpress.com, which is a very important go-to site to understand what makes this great empire, which doesn't call itself an empire, U.S. imperialism. On the fundamental issue, the U.S. has 800 bases, my understanding is that's just a ballpark figure. It's probably more, 800 bases. It has fighting ships in every ocean of the world, and it apparently docks pretty much where it wants to dock, and it points its weapons at people. It talks in a very intimidating way. It has now for half a century. We've had a liberal, they call him Obama, we've had Carter, et cetera. When you see them get into a mess like they are now in Syria, but leaving the other messes behind in Libya, and elsewhere, there is a question, can they And then one other name could come up here. Corbyn in Britain says, we don't have to have these kinds of policies. There's no one in Canada or the United States ever talks like that. But were they to talk like that, is there any chance that they could come to their senses? Or does this huge international network of power have to just keep going until it breaks its neck? I like that for a question. Is that nice? But imperialism, capitalism, that's your territory, so I get to do that.
I'm not sure I followed entirely.
Can they turn the motor off? Can they back off? The question is, you have the Pentagon, you have all these, a network of power, and it's based on the concept of an empire.
Mm-hmm.
They exploit the world's resources and the world's labor. They make war when they feel like it. And so, but they've gotten themselves in a mess here in Syria. And you say, can they lose face? Can they back away from that?
That's a difficult question to answer.
Yeah.
I think they can be forced to back away. I don't think they would willingly back away. They might be placed in a situation in which they have to step back.
A tactical withdrawal.
Yes.
But that they will return to it, right?
Absolutely, I believe. I mean, if you look at the pattern of U.S. foreign policy, maybe since the country's inception, it's been an expansionary one, kind of driven by commercial and economic interests.
Mm-hmm.
And that will continue.
Yeah. Well, I'm very glad you say that. By the way, I get some of these ideas from reading your column, so it just, you kind of are confirmed by thought. But I do remember that Mark Twain and William James and some others argued in 1900 that the United States should not – they said it out – they wrote the title, Don't Become Imperialist.
Mm-hmm.
But all the better brains, guys like Teddy Roosevelt, said, imperialism is good for you. So now that's where they are.
Mm-hmm.
They've made the commitment.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that imperialism is really a policy choice, which I think was the point you were trying to make mm-hmm. earlier. I don't think that you can simply say, let's be imperialist this year. Next year we won't be. I think any large capitalist country which has the kind of resources that the United States has will necessarily be imperialist.
Mm-hmm.
And, occasionally people in Canada pat our backs collectively and say, we're not as aggressive and expansionary and imperialist as the United States is. But in the U.S. situation, I believe that we'd be just as aggressively imperialist.
Yeah. Well, and also nobody here ever objects to them, our big neighbor. It's all bark, bark. I'm with you. It's a smaller dog running with a big one, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So who knows what's waiting for the pack around the corner? Stephen Gowans, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Gowans.wordpress.com. Thank you very much.
And thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. That's Stephen Gowans.